manner of judging the character of a person at first sight. Moreover, he had such a look of benevolence that I did not wish to distrust him. I therefore made him my bow, and said, "I have not the least doubt about your honorable intentions, and am quite sure that you are a reliable guide." "One cannot be careful enough in selecting one's guides," continued the stranger. "There are at present so many false prophets and guides. All the world is at present crazy for poking their noses into the mysteries of the astral world. Everybody wants to be taught witchcraft and sorcery. Secrets, which for thousands of years have been wisely kept hidden before the eyes of the unripened, are now bawled out selfishness and ambitions of their disciples, and, the blind leading the blind, they both come to grief. If only all the seekers for truth were like you, they would not be deluded by false promises held out to them for attaining adeptship." "I am really glad," I answered, "that you have discovered my purity and unselfishness of purpose, and I hope that, in consideration of my merits, you will be kind enough to show me some more of your occult secrets. Theodorus has already been preaching long sermons to me, and I listened to him with great patience, but now am I wont to see something substantial, and if possible learn how to perform some occult feats." "Most willingly," said my companion. "I will do all I can for you, because you deserve by your unselfishness the patronage of all the adepts." So saying, he began to show me some of the curiosities of the laboratory, which contained many strange things. Of some of those I had read in books on alchemy, others were entirely new to me. At last we came to a closed shrine, and my curiosity led me to ask what it contained. "Oh," answered the monk, "this shrine contains some powders for fumigations, by the aid of which a man may see the elemental spirits of nature."
"Indeed," I exclaimed. "Oh, how I should like to see these lovely spirits. I have read a great deal about them in the books of Paracelsus, but I never had an opportunity of seeing them."
"They are not all of them lovely," said the monk. "The elementals of earth have human forms. They are small, but they have the power to elongate their bodies. These gnomes and pygmies are usually ill, humored and cross, and it is just as well to leave them alone, although sometimes they become very good friends of man, and may even show him hidden treasures and mines. The elementals of air, the sylvans, are of a more agreeable nature, still we cannot rely upon their friendship. The salamanders, living in the element of fire, are ugly customers, and it is better to have nothing to do with them. But the nymphs and undines are lovely creatures, and they often associate with man. I wish I could see those beautiful water sprites," I said, "but I am inclined to believe that they belong to the realm of the fable." For many years, accounts given by seafaring men spoke of mermen and mermaids, which they insisted on having seen at a distance. They said that those people were like human beings, of whom the upper part resembled a man or a woman, while the lower part of their body was a fish. They told great stories about their beauty, their waving hair, and how finely they could sing, and they called them sirens, because it was said they could sing so well that men who heard their voices would become oblivious of everything else but their songs. At last, such a siren was caught, and it proved to be nothing else than a curious fish of the species called halic or catica, which at a distance may be mistaken for a man, on account of its color, and which barks somewhat like a dog. Perhaps those undines and nymphs are also nothing but fishes."
"This is a most erroneous opinion, my dear sir," answered the monk. "The halicore is a fish, but the nymphs and undines are elemental spirits of nature, living in the element of water, being, under ordinary circumstances, invisible to man, and not being able therefore to be caught in this manner. They are almost like human beings, but far more ethereal and beautiful, and under certain circumstances they may be seen by man. They may even attain a permanent material form and remain on land, and a case is even known in which a certain Count Stauffenberg married such a nymph on account of her beauty and lived with her for more than a year, until some stupid theologian frightened him by telling him that his wife was a devil. The count at that time had fallen in love with some good-looking peasant girl, and so the interference of the preacher was welcome, and he took this as a pretext to drive his true wife away. But she revenged herself, and on the third day after his second marriage the count was found dead in his bed. These nymphs are very beautiful. They are strong in love, and are constant, but they are also said to be very jealous. The more the monk spoke about the water, nymphs, the stronger grew my desire to see them. I asked him to put me in communication with those beautiful spirits, but he made all sorts of excuses, which, however, only served still more strongly to excite my curiosity. We are living here in this sinful world, and ought not to meddle with the inhabitants of another. We are all sinners and liable to succumb to temptations. These water nymphs are continually seeking to be united with men, and they have good reason for it, because they have no immortal souls. Becoming united with man, they form a link with his soul, and thus partake of his immortality. Why, then, I exclaimed, do you hesitate to conjure these beings? I would only be too happy to convey the gift of immortality to one of these beautiful spirits. Moreover, I would consider this as an act of charity and duty, and if such a nymph should insist upon marrying me, I can see no reason why I should object if she were amiable. Besides, it would be quite an extraordinary thing to have a water nymph for a wife. They are not only very amiable, said the monk, but they are also very obedient to their husbands. Such a water nymph has no will of her own. She regards her husband as her savior and God, never contradicts or scolds him, but is always ready to obey his commands, fulfill his wishes, and gratify his desires. She is very modest in her demands, needs no luxuries, and requires nothing except occasionally a short excursion to the seashore, which will cause you no expense whatever, because she has her own method of traveling. I could restrain myself no longer, and earnestly begged the monk to make a fumigation with the mysterious powder. At last he consented. Putting a few pieces of dry maple tree bark and some dried leaves of laurel into a brazier, he added pieces of charcoal and lighted them. He then strewed some of the mysterious powder, and a white smoke arose, filling the room like a mist and with a very sweet odor. The objects in the laboratory could soon be seen only dimly through that mist, and finally disappeared altogether. The walls of the chamber were no more to be seen. The air seemed to take on a vibratory motion and to become more dense, but, far from feeling oppressed by this, I felt a great exhilaration and satisfaction. At last I knew I was in the element of water, and was supported by it. I was swimming, but my body was as light as a feather, and it required no effort whatever to keep me from sinking. It seemed as if the water was my own element, as if I were born in it. A light shone directly above my head. I rose up to the surface and looked around. I was in the midst of the ocean, dancing up and down with the waves. It was a bright moonlight night. Right above me stood the full moon and threw her silvery rays upon the water, causing the ripples and the foamy crests on the tops of the waves to sparkle like liquid silver or diamonds. Far in the distance appeared the coast with a mountain range, which seemed familiar to me. At last I recognized it as the coast of the island of Ceylon, with a range of mountains beyond Colombo and Galle. Surely I could not mistake, for I recognized the Adam's Peak. Never shall I forget the agreeable sensation caused by the ethereal bath in the moonlit sea in the Indian Ocean. It seemed to me that at last my wish had been fulfilled, and that I was free of my mortal body and its weight, and yet I was myself. I could see no difference between the body I inhabited now and the one I inhabited before the fumigation was made, only my present body was so light that it seemed as if it would float in the air as easily as its. It comes nearer, and now am I hear it plainly. It is the melodious song of a female voice. I look in the direction from which the sound seems to come, and I see three forms floating upon the waves, rising and sinking and coming nearer. They seem to play with each other, and as they approach I behold three beautiful females with long, waving hair, but the one in the middle surpasses the others in beauty. She seems to be the queen, for she wears a wreath of water, plants upon her head. Still nearer they come. Now they see me and stop. They consult together, but curiosity conquers their fear. They come quite close and speak to me. Their voices are full and melodious, their language is foreign to me, and yet I understand what they say. Having discovered that I am a mortal, they appear as anxious to cultivate my acquaintance as I am anxious to be on friendly terms with them. They invite me to go with them to their home, they speak of their palace constructed of beautiful shells among the coral, reefs in the depths of the ocean, of the milk, white pearls with which they have ornamented the walls, of the azure blue of the waves shining through the transparent walls of their houses, and the curious things which no mortal had ever seen. I object, and tell them that I am mortal and that I could not live in their own element, but the beautiful queen, rising out of the water up to her waist, smiles and shakes her charming head, and fluid diamonds seem to stream from her waving locks. Come, she whispers, no harm will befall you, for my love shall protect you. She extends her beautifully shaped arms towards me and touches my shoulder, and at her touch my consciousness fades away. A voluptuous sensation pervades my whole being. I feel that I am dissolving in the element of water. I awoke, and opening my eyes, I found myself stretched upon the moss, in the shadow of that mighty pine, where I had evidently fallen asleep. The sun stood still high above the western horizon, and far up in the sky two vultures described long-drawn spirals in the air, and in their cries I seemed to recognize the voice of the queen of the nymph of the gold. I put my hand into my pocket, and there, among the few remaining silver pieces, I found a solid lump of gold as bright as the purest, but the little ruby pearls had dropped off from its surface and were lost. I then recollected the precious book which the adept had promised to send to my room in the village inn, but somehow it seemed to me that I had committed an indiscretion during the absence of Theodorus by prying into the secrets of his laboratory and listening to the temptations of the nymphs. I felt as if I did not deserve the favor, and was doubtful whether or not he would send me the book. I flew rather than walked down the mountain, along the road leading toward the village. Little did I now care for the scenery, neither for the mountain tops, which were gilded by the rays of the setting sun, nor for the murmuring river. It grew dark, and the full moon arose over the hills, looking exactly like the moon I had seen some hours before in the Indian Ocean. I calculated about the difference of time between Germany and Ceylon, and I found that indeed I might have seen the moon shine in the Bay of Bengal while the sun was shining in the Alps. I arrived at O. Little heeding the astonished looks of the villagers, who may have believed me insane as I hurried through the streets. I entered the inn, rushed upstairs to my room, and, as I entered, I saw upon the table the precious book, the secret symbols of the Rosicrucians of the 16th and 17th centuries. On the fly, leaf were written a few lines in pencil, saying, "Friend, I regret that you left our home so abruptly, and I cannot invite you to visit us again for the present. He who desires to remain in the peaceful valley must know how to resist all sensual attractions, even those of the Water Queen. Study this book practically. Bring the circle into a square. Mortify the metals, calcinate and purify them of all residua. When you have succeeded, we shall meet again. I shall be with you when you need me. Yours fraternally, Theodorus." It may be imagined that, in spite of my fatigue, I did not go to sleep very early. I walked up and down in my room, thinking over the events of that memorable day. I tried to find the line between the visible and the invisible, between the objective and subjective, between dreams and reality, and I found that there was no line, but that all these terms are merely relative, referring not merely to the conditions of things which appear objective or subjective to ourselves, but to our own conditions, and that while in one state of existence certain things may appear real to us and others elusive, in another state the illusions become real, and that which before seemed to be real is now merely a dream. Perhaps our whole terrestrial life will seem to be at the end nothing else than a hallucination. As I walked about the room, I observed a Bible belonging to my host lying upon a cupboard. I felt an impulse to open it at random and to see what it said. I did so, and my eye fell upon the 12th chapter of the second epistle of the Apostle Paul, written to the Corinthians, where it said, I knew a man in Christ, above 14 years ago, whether in the body or whether out of the body I cannot tell, God knoweth, such a one was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Sadiud Din Muhammad Shahbistar, forgotten Islamic Sufi mystic. There remains one great expert on the life of Shahbistari, forgotten Islamic Sufi, mystic, Florence Lederer. Allow Florence to introduce you to the life of Shahbistari and the doctrines in which he lives, believed and experienced God. Life of Shahbistari, by Florence Lederer. It is inward glow that makes the Sufi, not the religious habit. Sadiud Din Muhammad was born at Shahbistar, near Tabriz, about AD 1250. He wrote the Gulshan-i-Raz, or Secret Rose Garden, as a reply to questions put forth by a Sufi doctor of Herat named Mursad Hosseini. Very little is known all of Muhammad Shahbistari's life. He wrote beside the Gulshan-i-Raz two treatises on Sufism called Hakul-Yagin and Rizal-i-Shaded. We learn he had a very favorite disciple called Sheikh Ibrahim. The Gulshan-i-Raz was introduced into Europe by two travelers in 1700. Later, copies of the poem were found in several European libraries. In 1821 Dr. Thalack, of Berlin, published extracts, and in 1825 a German translation of part of the poem appeared in another of his books. Afterwards a verse translation and the Persian text was published by von Hammerpurgstall in Berlin and Vienna. The Gulshan-i-Raz was translated into English and published, with the Persian text and extracts from Hammer's edition and Lajahi's notes, by Mr. Winfield in 1880. Sufi poetry. Readers of Sufi poetry for the first time are liable to be amazed, perhaps even repelled, by the extravagant language, by the familiarity with the deity, by the apparent disregard of all human and divine laws. But on further examination the wonder of the Sufis' love for their beloved shines out with a clear intensity, a beautiful luminous brightness. They are in love with the One, and their love takes the form of exquisite songs of praise and wonder. I heard entranced, my spirit rushed to meet love's welcome order, for the voice was sweet. Vaughan says, Oriental mysticism has become famous by its poets, and into poetry it has thrown all its force and fire. The Sufis have one sole and simple task, to make their hearts a stainless mirror for their God. Love is the Sufis' theme, divine, eternal love, and into this sea of love they cast themselves headlong. Rumi sings, moths, burnt by the torch of the beloved's face, are the lovers who linger in the sanctuary. If we are called madmen or drunkards, 'tis because of the cupbearer and the cup. Because my mouth has eaten of his sweetmeats in a clear vision I can see him face to face. End of that part of the book. Them jumping many pages further, we come to the headline, the enter, relation of the spheres. Moreover, friend, it is a good thing and a helpful to bear in mind our presence at all times, for we are near, and that in ways both many and various. When we are personally near at hand we are able to impress you with helpful thoughts and intuitions, and so to order events that your work may be facilitated and your way more clear than otherwise it would appear to you. Purified by suffering. Light and darkness are states of the spirit, as you know. When those dwelling in the darkness cry for light, that means that they are become out of touch with their environment. So we send them what help is needed, and that is usually direction by which they find their way, not into regions of light, where they would be in torture, and utterly blinded, but, into a region less dark, and tinctured by just so much of light as they may bear until they outgrow that state and cry in their longing for more. When a spirit leaves a dark region for one less dark, he experiences an immediate sense of relief and comfort by comparison with his former state. For now his environment is in harmony with his own inner state of development. But as he continues to develop in aspiration after good, he gradually becomes out of harmony with his surroundings, and then, in ratio to his progress, so his discomfort increases until it becomes not less than agony. Then in his helplessness, and approaching near to despair, Having come to that pass when his own endeavors can go no further, he cries for help to those who are able to give it in God's name, and they enable him one stage onward nearer to the region where dimness, rather than darkness, reigns. And so he at last comes to the place where light is seen to be light, and his onward way is henceforth not through pain and anguish, but from joy to greater joy, and hence to glory and glory greater still. But oh, the long, long ages some do take until they come into that light, ages of anguish and bitterness, and know all the time that they may not come to their friends who wait them until their own unfitness is done away, and that those great regions of darkness and lovelessness must first be trod. But do not mistake my words of their meaning. This is no vengeance of an angry God, my warden friend. God is our Father, and He is love. All this sorrow is of necessity, and is ordered by those laws which govern the sowing, and the reaping of that which is sown. Even here, in my own place, where many things both wonderful and lovely we have learned, yet not yet have we attained to plumb and sound this mystery to its lowest depth. We do understand, as we were unable when in the earth life, that it is of love that these things are ordained. I say we are able to understand where formerly we were able but to say we trusted and believed. Yet little more of this awful mystery do we know, and are content to wait until it is made more plain to us. For we know enough to be able to believe that all is wise and good, as those in those dark hells will know one day. And this is our comfort that they will and must be drawn onward and upward into this great and beautiful universe of light, and that then they will confess, not only that what is just, series, by Reverend G. Valoin, The Greater World Association, UK, 1922. Next is, Swami Abhedananda, forgotten Hindu mystic. Swami Abhedananda, wrote a series of profound works but is most known for his auspicious association with Sri Ramakrishna, a well-known and highly respected Hindu saint in the late 1900s. One of his original 15 disciples, Swami Abhedananda had the distinction of spending much of his life in the presence of this. His name meant that which has no differentiation, and it was given to him shortly after Ramakrishna's death. His original name at birth was Kali Prasachandra. In his youth, Swami Abhedananda was known for his scholarly pursuits, learning Sanskrit and studying venereal illness. Swami Abhedananda was one of those disciples who stayed closest to his side and nursed him in his final hours. Swami Abhedananda had another well-known association, that of Swami Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna's direct successor. In 1896, Swami Vivekananda sent for Swami Abhedananda in New York and had him take over the running of the Vedanta Society, of which he was very successful and stayed on until 1921. Upon return to India, he founded his own Vedanta Society. Although many do not remember Swami Abhedananda, he led a profoundly holy life surrounded by very holy men of great note. There are many fascinating works to his own name of great worth, and in 1939, he was the only living person and only disciple remaining, alive, who had met and known Sri Ramakrishna, a fact which 468 gave him unusual distinction in his later years. Perhaps a great introductory work to this great forgotten mystic is his work describing what is a yogi, How to Be a Yogi, by Swami Abhedananda, 1902, 4th edition, Vedanta Society, New York, USA, Notice of Attribution, scandatsacredtexts.com, January, 2005. John Bruno Hare, Redactor. This text is in the public domain in the United States because it was published prior to 1922. These files may be used for any non-commercial purpose, provided this notice of attribution is left intact. How to Be a Yogi by Swami Abhedananda. Introductory. True religion is extremely practical. It is, indeed, based entirely upon practice, and not upon theory or speculation of any kind, for religion begins only where theory ends. Its object is to mold the character, unfold the divine nature of the soul, and make it possible to live on the spiritual plane, its ideal being the realization of absolute truth and the manifestation of divinity in the actions of the daily life. Spirituality does not depend upon the reading of scriptures, or upon learned interpretations of sacred books, or upon fine theological discussions, but upon the realization of unchangeable truth. In India, a man is called truly spiritual or religious not because he has written some book.